Okay, thank you very much. I'm Ben Holder. I work with Catherine Boschman, as she mentioned a few times this morning. The study of influenza infections, you can look at on a spectrum that goes from the smallest scale, the micro scale, where you have the virus particle and its interaction with the cell and the genome of the virus, all the way up to the largest scale where you have infections of human beings, the clinical scale. And that's mathematical modeling really provides a bridge between these two scales. That's what we're trying to use the mathematical model for. And in particular, that bridge can go in a couple of different ways. At the smallest scale, we know a lot about the virus particle itself. So we've heard a lot about that already today. But we know what the structure of the virion is. We know how it enters a cell. This is actually a picture from a recent paper where they showed viruses, not influenza, something else I can't remember, actually entering cells and being repelled by cells. We know the entire genome of the virus, and we can actually construct viruses with any particular genome that we like. So we have a lot of control over the microscale, and we also know a lot about the way that it infects cells. So that informs the models that we build. But what I'm going to be talking about today is more about in the other direction, where we want to take in vitro experiments, some controlled laboratory experiments on a macroscopic scale, and try and extract from that the small scale parameters, the infection kinetics parameters of the microscale. But the reason for doing all of that, of course, is to eventually have some ability to talk about the larger scales, to influence the disease itself, to talk about why some strains are more virulent than other strains, why some strains are resistant and are able to survive in comparison to resistant to drugs, sorry, and are able to survive in comparison to others, and to use the information that we get from these controlled experiments to measure the effect of antivirals and things like that. So let me just again show the model, which we've seen already 20 times in the past 2 days. But we have a class, we have four classes of cells. Target cells are infected by virus at some rate, beta, and then they become latently infected cells. Those latently infected cells then last for some characteristic time, the time of latent infection, tau L, before they become infectious, meaning they start releasing virus particles. And those infectious cells last for some amount of time before they die. And virus particles go on to infect other cells or are cleared at some rate, called the clearance rate. And this really, this model itself tells us what the basic philosophy of this work is. It's that we believe there are just a few parameters, here five, which represent the interaction between the virus and the cell. And if we have the value of those parameters and we have some dynamical systems model, then we can predict the dynamics of any scale of infection that we like. And in that way, we can understand some of these larger scale infections in the lungs. And there's a caveat on that. I'm only going to be talking about in vitro infections, so I'm not going to include anything about the immune system here. And the reason that, well, the reason that I am doing that is because we don't actually know the answer to this simple problem. We don't actually know what the value of these parameters are in even the simplest, most controlled cases. So if we can solve that problem, then we might be able to learn what we need to add on when we start looking at something where there's an immune system involved or other effects on the model. So I'm going to stick to a simple model, and we're going to try and extract some of these parameters. And the extraction of the parameters, there are two basic problems. One is a mathematical problem, which is, let's assume that in some magical world we have an experiment which exactly reproduces what our model gives us. Basically, the world is a simulator of our mathematical model. In that case, based on the measurements we're making, can we actually extract all of these parameter values? And the answer is no in many cases. So if you're just looking at viral titer data from a human patient or something, and your model involves cells along with virus, you may not actually be able to get things like the lifetime of a cell out of that data. So it's important when you're trying to get these parameters to make sure that you're able to get the parameters mathematically. And that's one problem that we have to deal with. The other one is a biological problem of whether this model is, in fact, correct. So we know that it's certainly not correct down to the smallest scales. We're ignoring a lot of things that go on within the cell. But I guess the way I'd phrase the question is, does the model work for the system that I'm looking at today, and does it work for other macroscopic systems that I might want to look at? So if I look at a whole bunch of different kind of in vitro systems, will my model work for all of them? And the answer to that is also no in many cases, and that's what I'll be talking about in the second part of my talk. But first, let me talk about one project that we've been working on. We've been trying to get the infection kinetics parameters from these in vitro experiments. And our particular application for doing this has to do with drug-resistant viruses. We've heard a lot already about the seasonal flu. It was found out just before the pandemic hit last year that our seasonal flu, the dominant strain, was resistant to our primary anti-influenza drug, oseltamivir. And this was a surprise to the community because although it had been known there was a mutation in the neuraminidase gene, this H275Y, which conferred the resistance, we had seen in different in vitro experiments and in animal models that the strain became much less fit once it got that mutation, and it wouldn't survive in comparison with any of the wild type strains. So no one thought that it was going to be a problem. But it turned out that it was a problem, because right before swine flu hit, almost 100% of those isolates from patients were resistant to the drug. And a side note to that is that since swine flu hit, the Brisbane strain, the seasonal strain, is gone now. And swine flu is actually susceptible to the drug so far. So in some sense, the pandemic has sort of saved us from this public health crisis that we just almost went into. And this work is, that I'm talking about is important because, of course, swine flu may in fact develop the same type of resistance, and it's important to know how that happened in the past, although we don't really have to suffer for it right now for some reason. So what we'll be looking at is what are the kinetic differences between the susceptible and the resistant strain in this, of this seasonal type, which underlie the differences that are known in its fitness and in the genotype of the virus itself. So we look at two experiments. Both of them are prepared in sort of the same way. We have a cell culture of a monolayer of dog kidney cells, which you apply a dilute solution of virus to for about an hour, and in that time you infect maybe 10 or 20 of the million cells in that dish. And then you apply an overlay. You remove the virus completely, apply an overlay, and that's the difference between the two experiments. You apply a gel overlay for the plaque experiment such that all infections are constrained to a small little region around the initially infected cells, and you get these small circular regions of dead cells called plaques. And the other case, you have the viral yield experiment where you put a liquid overlay such that the infected cells can release the virus can spread throughout the medium, and you get an exponential growth of infected cells and virus very quickly. And these two experiments are, I say, complementary views of the virus replication. And you can see that in the results that we have here. These are the results that were done by our experimental collaborators in Quebec. This is viral plaque growth. So what you're looking at here is the growth of the plaque radius, these little circles, as they grow in time. You can see that there's a delay here and then a linear growth for some time, and then at some point it dies out for reasons we're not quite sure why. But there is a linear growth here in the beginning, and you can see that the wild type actually grows faster than the mutant here. So one might say, if you only looked at this experiment, that the wild type is a fitter strain than the mutant. But that's only one measure. If you look at the other experiment, you can see that the mutant strain grows earlier, and it also grows at a greater exponential rate than the wild type strain. So when I say complementary, I mean they seem to be dependent on different parts of the replication cycle, because one seems more fit in one experiment than the other. So the way that we model this is we use that basic model and we consider two implementations of it. For the plaques, we use a PDE with a delay term in it, and I won't go into the details of any of these, but basically this is a reaction diffusion equation which supports some traveling solutions. If you start out with a small infectious population at small radii, then very quickly it'll develop into something that looks like this, where all of these fields are traveling across at the same velocity, and we just measure that velocity for a given set of parameters, and that's the plaque velocity, the speed of that infection wave traveling across the cells. For the yield experiments, we use a delay differential equation, and instead of actually simulating the full experiment, you could actually solve for the exponential growth rate, that initial growth rate of the virus titer, and we get a transcendental equation for that based on just a couple of assumptions in the early times of this experiment. So in each case, we have the plaque velocity, the measured plaque velocity from the experiment, which we can find dependent on all of the parameters of the system, and the growth rate, which in this case will depend on the clearance rate, the production rate, the infection rate, and tau L, the latent infection period. So we have a problem because we have two experimental measures and we have five parameters in the model. We need to reduce the number of parameters that we have in order to actually get some information. And luckily, in this set of systems, we can. So the first reduction, it turns out that both the plaque velocity and the exponential growth rate depend only on the rates of production and infection in their product, this quantity P beta. So we define a characteristic time, which we call the infecting time. It's given by this, and that you can show that that quantity is in fact the amount of time that it takes one infectious cell, one virus-producing cell, to cause the latent infection of one more cell in a completely susceptible population. You can derive that from the delay differential equations that I showed on the previous page. So it has some physical meaning. It has something to do with the infectivity of the virus strain. And then there are two other parameters which we can basically exclude consideration of. The infectious lifespan of the cell doesn't seem to affect either of those quantities very much, the growth rate of the plaques or the exponential growth rate. And the viral clearance we can extract from the viral yield experiments in the decay rate. So we end up with only two parameters. We have two experiments and two parameters. Yes, Jim? No. So I'm fixing the death rate to something which we think is reasonable. But the point is that different values of that infectious cell death rate don't affect the value of the two quantities of interest, the plaque velocity or the exponential growth rate, because the growth rate happens in the early stages when hardly any cells have died yet. It measures the exponential rate at which the infectious population grows. So in our models, we never have any death of latent cells. The death only happens after the infectious population. And that, whether that's a true assumption or not, I'm not sure. It should be something that could be looked at. But basically, we don't have any death of latent cells, so it's only a question of how long they live while producing virus. There's no death of any other type of cell. Is that what you're asking? So the death term is right here. It's a delay term. So basically, the transition out of the target state, there's an implied latent phase here, such that they only appear in the infected state some tau L time later, and then some tau L plus tau I time later, they disappear from the infected state and go into an implied dead state. They have both of them are fixed. That's right. So there are many assumptions that can be made, and I'm going to talk about them later, but this was sort of the simplest of the realistic possible choices. Yes, sorry.
Could you have a cell that infects, let's say, a virus that infects two cells at the same time, let's say, infects one cell?
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's just a mathematical concept to give some meaning to this. In fact, when you derive this, you could say that it's the amount of time that a population of cells, of N cells, producing virus over their entire lifespan, so you let them produce virus, and will cause the latent infection of that number more cells. So if you have N cells, the time it takes to get to two N cells is the infecting time. And it's you'd never have a situation where you'd actually be able to observe that, because it depends on a completely susceptible population. So you just have one infectious cell spitting out virus, and you watch to see how many get latently infected, or how long it takes for one more to get latently infected. Okay? So we've gotten to the point where we have two experimental measures. We have two parameters, and I can actually figure out what the dependence of each of those experimental measures are in our model on each of those two quantities. So we have latent infection period on the y-axis, infecting time on the x-axis. Not very interesting to look at, but this tells us what the velocity is for any value of those parameters and what the exponential growth rate is. And we can apply this then to the measured values. So what I'm showing here are contour plots representing the possible values of the parameter pairs, which are consistent with the experimental measures. So the two contours here represent the 1 and 2 sigma error bars corresponding to the experimental measure and its error. And you can see that there are certain parameters associated with the wild type strain for the plaque velocity. There are certain parameters which are consistent to its viral yield growth rate. And then if you take the product of these two functions, these are unit Gaussians that I'm using to construct these figures, you can see which parameter values are consistent with both experiments together. And this gives us a sense of what the parameter values are for the particular strain. And it's a range that we have, but it does tell us something about the kinetics of each strain. And in particular, what it shows is that the resistant strain has a much longer latent infection period. It takes longer for the resistant viruses to detach from the cells than for the wild type. However, the resistant strain also has a much smaller infecting time, meaning it takes longer to get the virus off of the cell, but once that virus is released, it can infect cells much more quickly than those of the wild type strain. And this is consistent with a recent result concerning the mechanism that we think surrounds this problem about H274Y mutation and also the seasonal strain, which is that it was found that this most recent Brisbane seasonal strain has more neuraminidase on the surface than earlier strains. And while the mutation reduces that amount of neuraminidase, it only brings it back to the level of the previous strains. So the amount of neuraminidase on this particular mutant for the most recent seasonal is about the same as the previous strains. And the fact that it has less neuraminidase on the surface makes it more sticky, so it takes longer to release from the cell, but also makes it easier to attach to the next cell that it comes to. So the result we get is a nice one that's consistent with some other explanations for this problem. But, and we'll move on to the next part of my talk, this solution that we got is actually not unique in the sense that we chose a particular model. We chose those fixed delays in going from one infected state to another. And there are other possible choices that you could make. And in fact, we've done simulations with alternative delays. So we've considered changing the distribution of these times, the time that it takes to go from latent to infectious or infectious to dead, from the fixed delay that we use to an exponential, meaning we use a PDE model and an ODE model, or normal distributions or log normal distributions using some stochastic models. And we found that the basic result is robust, meaning that results about the latent infection period being longer for the mutant, but the actual values of the parameters change. And if you want to use our results in order to simulate other types of experience, we need to be able to depend on the value of those parameters. They need to have some meaning, or else we'd only be able to really simulate the exact same experiment again. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to be able to first have a model which allows for more generic delay assumptions, and second, have an experimental system which will be able to differentiate between the different delays. Because so far, all of these models are able to reproduce a linear growth in the plaques and also that exponential growth in the viral yield experiment. So in the first case, luckily, a model for generic delays exists, and it actually has for a long time. When the SIR model was introduced by Kermick and McKendrick, they actually started with a very generic view of how delays happen between states, And at the end of their paper, they say, well, let's look at exponentially distributed transitions, because then you get to an ODE model. And from there, the ODE model has basically taken hold, and it's used in many both epidemiological and in-host models. And then there was a nice paper by Heathcote and Tudor where they reviewed this type of model and its use in epidemiological situations. So we're going to use it. I'm not going to go through these at all, except to mention that it depends on the probability density function for the state lifetime and on 1 minus the CDF corresponding to that distribution. So these are some possibilities. This is the probability that a cell remains in a state after a certain amount of time, or at least for this long. So you can see that the exponential distribution, you have some transitions that are happening almost immediately. So in this case, after 4 hours, you've already have 20% of the cells transitioned, whereas all the other ones enforce some fixed delay before the transitions start to happen, which we think is more biologically realistic. And the experiment that we're looking for is this experiment called single cycle growth. It's another in vitro experiment, except in this case, instead of a dilute concentration of virus, you put a very strong concentration of virus on the cells such that all of them are infected during the inoculation period. And what you get are these kind of curves. If you look through the literature, I've looked through the literature, I can tell you, these are what they look like. And they're often plotted like this, with a logarithmic scale for the virus, and they have this sort of candy cane-like shape to them. And when we started looking at them, we didn't really know what to do with them. And it was only once we plotted the virus in linear scale that it started to make sense. What you see here, if you plot the same data in linear scale, you see there's a long delay with basically no virus production. And then, at some moment, the cells start to produce virus at a constant rate. And so for each of these three strains, you can see they have a different production rate. And basically, if you measure the production rate directly from this graph, you can also measure some estimate of the latent infection period. And that's because this single cycle experiment sort of averages over a million cells the dynamics of a single cell. So you get an average view of the production dynamics for a cell. So what we did is we did some fits of this type of data using our different delay models. And the first thing we did was look at the exponential delay, meaning an ODE model. And if you try and start out an ODE model with all cells in the latent population, many of them will transition immediately, and you start to get virus production at very early times. So it's almost impossible to get this long delay with no virus production and then a linear growth. And in fact, these two curves are two possible fits to the data under a couple of different assumptions. But this is the best you can get for an ODE model when trying to reproduce this experiment. These are two other experiments. I chose the experiments based on those that had some nice, good sampling of data in time. And I put it back on the log scale so that we could see the early viral release. And what you see here are a solid line is a normal distribution, and the dashed is the log normal distribution. Both of those fit the data quite well, both when viewed in log scale, and this is also in linear scale. And I considered two possible viral clearances because we didn't have an estimate for the viral clearance in each case. So in either assumption, either if you completely neglect viral clearance during this time, or if you assume some fixed value of viral clearance, both of those models provide a good fit. However, the fixed delay provides a very poor fit, and that's simply because it can't reproduce this smooth, basically the tails of the distribution, allowing for a little bit of virus release before the mean. And there's one more way that you can look at these single, yes? No. And in fact, no. The answer is no. So. Which down and back up again? Which part do you mean? This part here. I don't know. I'm not even sure if there is a down and back up again in these couple of points, but there may be. This. Here? Oh yeah, you're right. These definitely do. So this is an example. I didn't actually fit these data. This is an example of influenza B. But you're right. It does have that there. The virus that you see there is virus that's left over. So they put a huge amount of virus in this little petri dish, and they wash it all off after the inoculation period. But there's so much there that you're bound to have some left. So the stuff that you see in these early times is basically the amount of virus left over, and that may be clearing out with some clearance before the cells start to produce virus again. But it may be something else, too. So the last thing I wanted to show is just another view of this single-cycle experiment, which is, we call it the single-cycle, single-history, because instead of using a whole set of different petri dishes and sacrificing them at each time point to measure the amount of virus that we have, this uses a single dish where they suck out all the virus at a given time point, titrate that, and then replace it with fresh medium. So the data points here show the amount of virus which has accumulated since the previous measurement. And therefore, instead of watching the total amount of virus that you have in the system, you're seeing the viral production as a function of time. So we fit that with our model, and you can see again that the normal and the log normal do a pretty good job of matching up with the data points. These drop-offs are due to the removal of the virus, which we do within the model by just taking out 99.9% of the virus. However, the exponential and the fixed delay do a very poor job of matching up. And you can see that even better if you transform the data. So since we're just looking at viral production, you can actually do a small transformation to make the data look like the infectious cell population over time, multiplied by that constant production rate. And you can see that the fit from the data is actually quite good in over the infectious cell population as well. However, the exponential and the fixed delay do a poor job. This is the last thing I have to say. I'm done almost. What's the point of all this? So the point is that we want to try and get a model which actually reproduces the biology, because in many of the places where we use this model to extract parameters, for instance, here in the clinical data, so this is some set of clinical data from a human volunteer experiment, you can see that all of the different models fit this data quite well. So the basic properties of exponential growth and exponential decay that we see in this type of experiment is fit by any of these models. So we can't discriminate between them. However, the parameters that you get out, if you use this to fit, will be all different. And if you want to use those parameters later to simulate other experiments to get some information about, for instance, how two strains might compare when put in competition with each other, then you really need to know what the actual values are. So in summary, we've gotten some kinetic parameters from these in vitro experiments. However, many observable features are reproducible by a wide variety of models. And we found an in vitro system which can actually discriminate between these models quite well. So if you'd like to read a little bit more, we have two papers which I can point you to as soon as they're available. They're in submission right now. These are some of our future work, which I guess I'll skip right now because I think I'm about done. And I'd just like to thank SharpNet, which is the Canadian supercomputer, which if you don't know about and you're in Canada, you should find out about. It's a great resource. And then my collaborators, Catherine, Laura Liao is an undergraduate, and our experimental collaborators, Guy Boivin and Philippe Simon. So thank you.